Being the kind of person that I am, and I like to give everybody a fair break. What I'm doing out of the kindness of my heart, I have a gentleman here named Frank Williams.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Following Rustic Exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 152 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winston. And because I stole a joke and I don't want to turn into the Carlos Mencia show here and I want to make proper restitution, it was a joke about The Wire and the Baltimore Ravens losing that I stole from Place to Be Nation's John D'Amato, who's on so many podcasts over there. If I tried to name them all, I'd get lost. It was about 40 degree days in Baltimore. And, well, it was 40 degrees, it had to have been, on that day that the Ravens lost to the Titans. Anyway, because I stole that joke and reference from him as somebody who never even watched The Wire, I'm going to do a request that he sent to me several months ago for this episode of, well, in actuality, he requested the April 14th, 1984 edition of WWF Championship Wrestling. However, the main reason why he requested it was for the Piper's Pit featuring Frankie Williams on there. Pardon my editorial laugh once again. But the edition of All-Star from the same weekend has a couple of advantages. Starting with, it has the same Piper's Pit segment. And it also has Rocky Johnson on it as well as part of a six-man. So given that he just passed this last week now, I can talk about him. It would be very appropriate. It has a Hulk Hogan match, and it's a different Hulk Hogan match than on Championship Wrestling, which is kind of interesting that he aired twice on that same weekend. So it's more or less the same, except All-Star being taped in Hamburg and not Allentown, even though we do get the dulcet tones of Joe McHugh, and we do get a few matches from Allentown. But before I get into all that, let me get in my plugs. You can email show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter, @GFAllentownPod. That is @GFAllentownPod. And you may be listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, where you can listen to some other fine shows like Days of Thunder, looking at WCW Thunder. They just celebrated their one-year anniversary. Congratulations, guys. And they gave out the Thundy, or the Thundies Awards. We also have the Bigfoot Pro Wrestling Podcast, looking at independent pro wrestling from the Pacific Northwest. And, of course, I'm going to leave the light on for WorldCast, which will come back as soon as internet reaches wherever Kelly Nelson is up in Canada. Apparently, you know, it's just a slow slog out to the farm in the countryside or wherever he is. But as I understand it, it will be back maybe not in a few weeks, but in a couple of months. I've already taken the liberty of going ahead and just started watching 1984 World Class episodes because I got confused at the end of 83 because they kept airing the same match over and over again. I wasn't putting on the same episode. I don't know what the hell was happening. So I just said, you know what, I'm just going to start at January of 84 and take it from there. So hopefully I can carve out a little bit more time for that going forward. The good news is I'm starting to feel like myself again, you know, without as many issues as I had starting a couple of weeks before Christmas with the gallstones. In fact, I'm even having a Miller Lite as I tape this right now. And in fact, this should just bring it right in, a nice continuity, right into my emergency medical update, brought to you by Lowell General Hospital, the place where Ahmed Johnson had his spleen surgery in 1997. This will be much quicker because the gallbladder incision's finally healed. I'm cleared now to lift more than 15 pounds at a time. I even operated the snowblower during a 5-6 inch snowstorm we had over the weekend. So I'm fine from that perspective. But I got some test results back last week, such as my MRI on my knee, which basically crippled me over Christmas. And I actually got some good news. Apparently, I did not tear any ligaments, which that's good. I also did not tear my meniscus. Apparently, this is just a really bad sprain. So, diagnosis, suck it up, old man. I don't know how the hell I wasn't able to stand up, like, even in the shower on Christmas morning. And the fact that that was just a sprain, a little bit unnerving. I mean, like, what does it feel like when you tear your ACL? Because I swear to God, like, I could not walk for several days afterwards. I mean, I went to freaking urgent care on Christmas morning. It does make me feel like a little bit of a wimp. But as for the growth of my face, which I talked in far too much detail last week, that they drained out, they are still requiring me to get a CAT scan, which will be tomorrow as I tape this. So I was hoping to avoid that simply because, well, it costs a lot of money and I have not spent up to my deductible yet. But that is, you know, just a fact of life of our healthcare system in the United States. And I'm not going to argue with the doctors, because they've done right by me to this point. It's just that it kind of screwed up my work schedule. I worked about 3 hours on the holidays so I could duck out and actually get the CT scan. And I'm just waiting for these bills to come in so I can just pay them. I have to admit, that's probably the worst part, having that hang over my head where you're not entirely sure how much it's going to cost, but, you know, maybe I should be playing Living in America instead of the opening and closing theme to the show Emergency from the 70s, which, in case you were wondering exactly what that is, I've been playing for the last 3 weeks. And speaking of Emergency, I posted this on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod on Sunday, because usually I've tried to record at least the intro to the show on that day. With the Monday holiday, and maybe I had a little bit more room, but on Sunday night, I became obsessed on YouTube with watching segments from the old TV series Rescue 911, hosted by William Shatner. I started out watching the Charles Stewart case, which was an unfortunate thing that happened here in Boston, where a man shot his pregnant wife because he didn't want to have kids. Then he shot himself and tried to frame a black man for the crime, which led to the Boston police searching every African-American neighborhood and basically fingering everybody as a suspect based on the color of their skin. Meanwhile, Charles Stewart's brother happened upon the scene, or, well, not happened upon, but he came, took the murder weapon, and, well, long story short, Rescue 911 had cameras in Boston that day, so that was not one of the reenactments. Instead, afterwards, I started watching all the reenactment ones, like the kid who got stuck on the slide, the kid who got stuck, he was dangling from a ski lift, which is why apparently my mother-in-law is afraid of ski lifts. These are all very good. I recommend you go and check out Rescue 911 on YouTube. I know it's not a comedy, but it might be an unintentional comedy in some ways if you end up picking the correct one. It was William Shatner who was the host of Rescue 911 on CBS at that time, when it started airing, I think, in 1989. But what's funny is, I was probably 9, 10 years old when it came on the air, and when I started watching it, that's what I thought William Shatner was famous for, because he was the host of Rescue 911. I didn't know him from anywhere else. I mean, I never watched Star Trek, I didn't know any of that stuff, I never watched any of those movies. Like, no, William Shatner, he's the guy from Rescue 911. It's kind of like a kid who, you know, coming up in like 2006 or whatever, who's like, oh yeah, that's the guy from the Priceline ads. I mean, those kind of things happen. I know, but anyway, back to wrestling here, because that's what this podcast is nominally about. April 14th, 1984. So Hulk Hogan is the world champion at this time. He had won the belt at the end of January, which I covered several episodes ago. That match aired on Championship and All-Star Wrestling as well. So we're in the very early stages of what they're building to. Like, WrestleMania, that's like almost a full year away from the time period that we're talking right now. In fact, this show All-Star was taped March 28th, 84 in, well, for the most part. As I said, there's going to be a mixture of things, but of course, taped in Hamburg, Pennsylvania. The opening to All-Star features Modern Love by David Bowie, and at the end has the Sergeant Slaughter leading the crowd in the Pledge of Allegiance, which I'll have a little bit more on Sergeant Slaughter a little bit later. I know he's been in the news. I know that there's been some journalists out there who think that for whatever reason they're going to win a Pulitzer Prize by blowing the lid off this wrestler isn't who he says he was bit. But another good thing about this program is we got original commercials from 1984, and you know how much I definitely enjoy that. But April 14th, 84, there was a show that night at the Boston Garden. Unfortunately, there's no attendance for it. But just kind of to give you the tenor of what was going on house shows at that time. I mean, and this seems pretty standard. They're not doing three shows a night. They haven't expanded out the roster yet. You've basically had two waves of guys coming in. You had the first wave, which was your mass superstar Paul Orndorff wave, which was about October of 1983. Those guys come in. I would say that Iron Sheik was part of that as well, him finally returning. Second wave is the Hogan, Piper, Okerlund wave, probably the most consequential of them all. And they all debut either at the St. Louis tapings, in Hogan's case, at the end of 83, or Piper comes in, very beginning of 84, Okerlund, he was an announcer on those St. Louis tapings. But anyway, back to that Boston Garden show from April 14th. No attendance listed here. New England Sports Network is basically in its infancy, so they ain't televising any of this. So here are our results. Salvatore Bellomo defeated Pete Doherty, the Duke of Dorchester, in 5:39. Ivan Putski over Rene Goulet. Greg Valentine defeated Brian Blair with via submission with the figure four at 11:36. Good. Iron Sheik defeated Sergeant Slaughter by disqualification. Roddy Piper and David Schultz, that's an interesting team, slightly different from the one we see on this show, defeated WWF Tag Team Champions Rocky Johnson and Tony Atlas via countout. So title, of course, not changing hands. Bob Backlund fought Paul Orndorff to a 20-minute time limit draw. That feels like a rather interesting match. You really don't think of those two guys crossing at all, but yes, they did have a match in Boston. Women's Tag Team Champions, Princess Victoria and Velvet McIntyre. So there's those women's tag team belts popping up in the 80s. Defeated Wendi Richter and Peggy Lee. Wendi Richter would play a much bigger role as we get later into 1984. And the final bout, which I don't know if I would say it was the main event, I would probably say Backlund and Orndorff was, but Intercontinental Champion Tito Santana pinned Tiger Chung Lee at 10:23. And that's the one thing that pains me about doing this episode of All-Star rather than Championship Wrestling is, while I do get a Hulk Hogan match, I do not get Hulk Hogan versus Tiger Chung Lee from the Championship Wrestling, because it's Hulkamania versus Chungermania. Instead, we get Hulk Hogan versus Afa of the Wild Samoans, which I guess is perfectly fine. So, you know, I'm just going to have to accept that. So, without any further ado, why don't I just get right into it? Because, like I said, there's commercials. There's a lot to get to on this program for WWF All-Star Wrestling, April 14th, 1984.
The new official World Wrestling Federation magazine on sale now. Come celebrate in the locker room with the new World Wrestling Federation champion, Hulk Hogan. Stand at attention for Sergeant Slaughter. Just how rowdy is Roddy Piper, the Von Erichs, the most dominant family in professional wrestling. A lavish shopping spree by the Iron Sheik, Wrestler of the Year, Superfly, Jimmy Snuka. Tito Santana's impossible dream comes true. How did Big John Studd become $30,000 richer in less than 14 minutes? And just how wonderful is Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff? These features and more in the official World Wrestling Federation magazine on...
It hadn't been too long since Victory Magazine had rebranded into WWF Magazine. Some interesting things in that issue, such as the Von Erichs, the most dominant family in wrestling. I'm just going to ignore the fact that David Von Erich had passed away 2 months earlier, in spite of the fact that it was probably printed before that. And the WWF did a toll of the bell when David Von Erich died at the Allentown tapings, which very, very unusual to see any sort of acknowledgement once Vince Jr. is in charge, and once he was done with the, well, let's show all the other territories tapes on All American so I can introduce my audience to these new guys coming in, like Barry Windham, that I'm going to poach eventually. John Studd in that $30,000, if I was reviewing the championship wrestling from this weekend, the update segment goes into that. He won a battle royal at the Keel, and he eliminated Andre the Giant and Hulk Hogan at the end of it, basically at the same time. I guess kind of like the Shawn Michaels eliminating both Vader and Yokozuna, except not completely bullshit and absolutely unbelievable. Anyway, I have some issues with the 96 Royal Rumble, and this is probably not the time nor the place to go into that. So our ring announcer for All-Star Wrestling is Gary Michael Capetta, who is very conspicuously edited out of most of the All-Star Wrestlings that you will see, probably in part because he still worked other promotions, which I'm sure Vince Jr. may have frowned upon, because Capetta is more of a Gorilla Monsoon guy anyway, and he's probably kept on because Vince did not want to piss off Gorilla too much. But Capetta would be left in there if it was absolutely necessary for him to be on it, which that's actually going to come up in this show. But that is not the case for our first match, which is we see the guys in the ring, Tito Santana, the Intercontinental Champion, taking on Israel Mattia, a real creature of this time period of WWF. You watch from 82 to 84. Odds are, you're going to see him on probably about every other show, but then after 84, you never see him again. And he probably turned up somewhere else, but I'm not too concerned about that. I'm much more interested in him as a WWF enhancement guy, unsung hero. This is very early in Tito's reign. He won the title off Magnificent Morocco at the Boston Garden in February. And what I did not know when it came to Tito, and maybe I just didn't look closely enough just looking up his history, did not realize that he worked in Toronto in January of 1984, which is interesting because, yes, while the WWF would eventually conquer Toronto, that's not till July. January, it's still a Crockett territory. So that is rather interesting. And he had been on WWF TV in late 1983. I mean, he was getting pushed towards the end of the year on that Intercontinental title track. He also worked for Paul Bosch down in Houston, and on January 27th, so this was in January of 84 as well, he was part of a six-man, which was a very interesting result indeed, which was Butch Reed, Barry Darsow, or Crusher Darsow, and Nikolai Volkoff defeated Tito Santana, Hacksaw Jim Duggan, and the Junkyard Dog. Every single one of them is in the WWF by this point in 1987. So a mere 3 years later, all of them are active in the WWF. They all go at different times, with the last one actually being Jim Duggan in March of 1987. Get a wide variety of challengers for Tito's Intercontinental title, at least beyond Magnificent Morocco, who'd already held the title twice and probably did not need it again. In fact, he disappears for much of 1984. Some of the guys that Tito ends up facing, of course, Paul Orndorff is one of them. He might be the main opponent, but also Iron Mike Sharp, which was where Tito had the big match with him towards the end of 83. I believe I covered that on the December 31st, 83 Championship Wrestling, episode 46. Check that out in the archives. Butcher Vachon, Iron Sheik, at least after Sheiky loses the title. Well, that's obvious because Tito doesn't win it until after Sheik's lost the title. Dr. D, David Schultz. And on March 31st, you get the first matchup between Tito and Greg Valentine, which goes to a time limit draw in 1650. I'd have to imagine that it was a 15-minute time limit, because I don't know why you'd go short on a Valentine-Tito match. I mean, that feels just downright criminal to me. But a rather interesting and peculiar Tito Santana match from this month in 84, in April, on the 23rd at Madison Square Garden, for which we're going to hear promos for that coming up a little bit later. J.J. Dillon taking on Tito Santana, basically the last example of a guy brought in from another territory, just kind of showcase at Madison Square Garden. Dillon, always wanted to work MSG, and he asked Vince Sr. for a favor, and Vince Sr. would be dead pretty much about a month later. And he was subbing, it says, for Afa, the Samoan, in that one. Both Tito and Mattia are in red hair, which I guess Vince wasn't so anal retentive about that sort of stuff back then. Then again, you think they would have learned from that Backlund Valentine finish in 81 where the ref counted or said the wrong guy had won because they were wearing the exact same gear. They do a couple of failed lockups to just kind of get things going. That actually happens three times. We get a waist lock takedown, but then Mattia gets to the ropes. And in fact, for our introduction to the show, usually for championship wrestling and for all-star wrestling, you would go to wherever Gene and Vince McMahon, Gene Oakland and Vince McMahon are our two commentators, and you'd see them and they'd kind of run down what was going to be on the show. I don't know what the hell happened here, but that's completely cut out, and you get little chyrons on there that say, the voice of Vince McMahon, and then when Oakland starts talking, voice of Gene Oakland. Rather strange, if you ask me. We get a very fast count by referee Dick Worley, as Tito's shoulders were down off a side headlock that he had applied. It was then that I realized that I was watching this on 1.25 times speed, but then I rewound it, and it was still a pretty fast count, and they actually remark upon it on commentary, as Tito, I guess, is working that St. Louis style. And yes, one of the other opponents he had was Alexei Smirnov, who he faced in St. Louis on one of those shows. Mattia, he's just sort of brawling. He actually bites Santana at one point. He's really no great shakes. He's just a guy that I happen to remember from the shows that I've seen in this time period. I think it's because his first name is Israel. I mean, if his first name was Zimbabwe, I'd probably remember him just as much. But Tito fires up, and he hits that flying forearm, which is definitely some quick offense from him. It's like he can hit his finisher literally at any time. And friggin' Mattia, he kicks out at 3.1. I hope he got reprimanded in the back for that, because this is the Intercontinental Champion he's facing here, and I was kind of annoyed by that. It's not like he has the greatest look to fall back on. I mean, for God's sakes, if you're facing the IC Champion, could you just leave your shoulders on the mat, and then once he gets off you, then you can roll out? I mean, give me a break.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, a feature that I'm very much looking forward to, my colleague, and the latest World Wrestling Federation update. Let's go directly to Vince McMahon.
That is definitely one for the Bizarro Files, where you got Gene Okerlund on commentary throwing it to the update segment, which is going to be hosted by Vince McMahon, because usually it's the exact opposite of that. But in the first quarter of 84, there's not a whole lot of hot angles going on. I mean, Hogan wins the title from Iron Sheik, fine, but it's not like they have an angle setting it up, you know, to extend it out past that point, because Iron Sheik, in the one hot angle that there was, is paired off with Sergeant Slaughter. So you can't really have the update on that every single week. So we're going to talk about Paul Orndorff, because that's kind of the default setting. Vince, he does not look as broad-shouldered as he is at the desk. Usually he would try to look like really big, like a cat or whatever, who's like puffed out trying to make themselves look big, which is a concept that is rather funny. It's like, all right, well, if you're up against a grizzly bear in the woods, make yourself look big. Like, oh, okay, so I weigh 230 now. If I put my arms out like this, I'll look like I weigh 243. Is that how it works? But Vince would, like, wear these suits that would try to make him look bigger. Not on this occasion, because, well, it's probably not worth it, because we're just talking about Mr. Wonderful, who is part of wave number one coming in, as I talked about in the intro, and just sort of his tactics that he's using, and like, okay, well, what is he doing? Is he using a loaded glove like Ted DiBiase would in Mid-South? Like, nah, he's just using the pile driver. Okay.
Paul Orndorff. Indeed, Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff, causing a lot of concern in professional wrestling today, given his most aggressive tactics. Tactics that are somewhat unbecoming of an individual whom states that, quite frankly, he will become a champion. In the official World Wrestling Federation publication, he is quoted as saying, "Everyone is going to see how winning a title is done in the proper way, the wonderful way."
Since there's really not a whole lot going on, it feels tailor-made for the Vince McMahon template of use a lot of big words, like the way he would talk, notwithstanding that, and all the other stuff that you've heard Vince McMahon say a million times. Like, okay, yeah, heel is using heel tactics, film at 11. Is that what we're trying to get? The only good thing is we do get, when they do show him delivering a pile driver, we at least got a, well, mildly humorous call of it from Gene and Vince.
Get on him! Get on him! Get up, boy! Get on him!
Oh, my goodness!
I'm picturing that as like the audio version of that GIF file that's been around for years that features Vince McMahon kind of sitting in a chair going, and then where he gets all, and then the part where he like, you know, opens his mouth and then falls backwards out of his chair. It's usually done, you know, when talking about Gary Stridham or something like that. That's what that feels like. And that's the only redeemable thing from this update segment because, well, like I said, maybe there's not a whole lot going on. I mean, sometimes, you know, it's not going to be a lot on the news. You're just going to have to fill it with stuff.
In the ring in a moment, ladies and gentlemen, Cowboy Bob Orton from Kansas City, 248 pounds of him. And without a doubt, one of the most accomplished professional wrestlers in the World Wrestling Federation today, Mr. Orton, getting ready to lock up with his opponent, Jose Luis Rivera from Puerto Rico at 231 pounds. Here we go.
All I can hear with Rivera at 231 pounds, I can just hear Rusty Brooks in the background just scoffing at that. It is nice to see AC Cowboy Bob Orton in this one. Hey, like from Kansas City. Now, to just put it in perspective, how long it's been since the Kansas City Chiefs had been to the Super Bowl. I know it's been 50 years, but Bob Orton hadn't even started wrestling yet at that point. He debuted in 1972. The Chiefs' last Super Bowl appearance was in January of 1970, where they defeated the even more star-crossed Minnesota Vikings in the fourth Super Bowl. But Orton, he debuts at the tapings the day before this. So this is the Hamburg ones on the 28th. He was in Allentown the day before. Had a nice little run in Jim Crockett Promotions in 1983. But it should be said that he's there in the WWF in 82, including challenges to Backlund while he was there through October of that year. The run in JCP in 83, he's part of the main event angle at Starrcade, where he and Dick Slater team up to get the bounty on Flair, levied by Harley Race. So a pretty good run by any standard. And he had a very, very slight overlap with his time with Jim Crockett Promotions and when he shows up for these tapings. He's got three matches in Crockett afterwards. So it's not quite like the Greg Valentine, who was effectively juggling two girlfriends for a couple of months between JCP and the WWF. Orton is just the greatest henchman in history. I mean, maybe that's overly strong praise, but as that guy who would stand behind Piper on all those Piper's Pits with the cast and, you know, his arms folded like so, and he's certainly a guy that you remember. I mean, hell, my friend Merrill, with all my health issues, he shows up to the Bruins game a couple of weeks ago, and he's got a cast on his left hand. So I've been calling him Ace Cowboy ever since. I'm not entirely sure if he knows what all that means, but if you wear a cast on your wrist or forearm, and I don't know what it's for, you're basically Bob Orton to me, as we start with a very bad hip lock by Jose Luis Rivera, as Howard Finkel runs down. Now, the WWF was debuting in a lot of new towns around this time period. They went to LA back in 83, and the breaking new ground. I talked about Chicago a couple of weeks ago, but screw all that. You are not truly a national promotion until you run a show in Wayne, New Jersey.
1 week from tomorrow night on Sunday, April 22nd, the World Wrestling Federation will make its initial appearance in Wayne, New Jersey at the William Patterson College Recreation Center. A big array of mat stars signed to appear, including Intercontinental Champion Tito Santana, two of the three Wild Samoans, and the one and only Bob Backlund. The roads will certainly lead to the William Patterson College Recreation Center, Wayne, New Jersey, for WWF Action, April 22nd.
They ran that venue about 8 times through October of 1987. They once had a Hogan Iron Sheik match, Valentine against Tito. Of course, it's probably some sort of independent show since like 1994. We're in the same venue that had Tito versus Valentine. They also had a Billy Jack Haynes versus Hercules chain match in 87. So, for whatever that's worth, the great metropolis of Wayne, New Jersey, which is in North Jersey. An arm drag by Jose Luis, who's using all 231 pounds on that frame. And Orton, he gains some measure of control, but into the corner where he charges with a knee, he actually runs into a knee, so which kind of looks a little bit botched. And I think at this point, Orton is like, all right, let's get the hell out of here and go home. Time to end this, as he puts Rivera up on the top rope, setting up for the superplex. And I always love when guys do the superplex where they roll over immediately into the pinning combination. Widowmaker Barry Windham did it in 1989 in a match that I just watched on one of the recently uploaded Primetime Wrestlings to the award-winning WWE Network. You know, they've taken a lot of grief for taking away hidden gems, but they did upload about 8 or 9 or 10 prime times from late summer of 89. But Orton, he does the same thing. Of course, the superplex in 84, still a relatively novel move, and I hope you're sitting down. And Vince McMahon, I defend his early work as a commentator, but even here in 84, Vince isn't, he's not sure what to call it.
Let's go back, take a look at that super suplex, Gene. Well, first of all, here's the pickup, the crouch, and a part of Cowboy Bob Orton getting Jose Luis Rivera up on that very top turnbuckle. Now Orton himself mounting the second rope, hooks the trunks of Rivera up and over, vertical suplex from high in the air. And there is no way that Rivera could have walked away from that one.
I'm glad Vince McMahon got a little bit better at one aspect of it, because here's the man who presided over when Mr. Perfect gets there 5 years later or so. They did not call it the perfect suplex. They called it the perfect plex. The super suplex. Oh, wow. It starts out with the same sound. With Sue, we could just call it the superplex. The powerplex by Power and Glory. And there's no way Jose Luis Rivera could have kicked out of that, except for the fact that he kicked out at 3.2 because he was watching Mattia a little bit earlier on. Oh, well. I mean, after all, judging from what we heard on TNT, Jose Luis Rivera is probably wearing a bracelet that says WWPMD. What would Pedro Morales do? Pedro would kick out at 3.2.
It's jam-packed with photos and details about Craftmatic beds. Now, you'll learn why adjustable beds are so superior to ordinary flatbeds, and read all about the adjustable bed sizes, the options, and important health benefits that you can obtain.
You'd see ads for Craftmatic beds all the time in the 80s, but I don't think I've seen one on regular television in the last 25 years. I'm not entirely sure why that is, if they just fell out of fashion or whatever. But the history of those type of beds is, well, I guess mildly interesting. As I don't know where the hell I pulled this from. It's from some bed website. Who knows? The early 1900s, Dr. Willis Dugatch took notice of the need to save patients from severe infection from being left lying flat after surgery. In the flat position, one was unable to move, and wounds stood the risk of not draining to heal. In 1909, Gatch took it upon himself to invent a bed system that would allow for one to sit up at rest to drain surgical lacerations properly. Ugh. The bed, known as the Gatch bed, was the basis for all adjustable bed frames to come. Split into three separate sections, each segment could be positioned as needed to situate the bed, yada, yada, yada. So it was a big deal, I guess, in World War One, and I would presume World War Two as well. So anyway, up next, we got a six-man match. The team of SD Jones and the World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions, Tony Atlas and Rocky Johnson, the recently deceased Rocky Johnson, taking on the team of Ron Shaw, Tony Colon, and John Callahan. Now, when Rocky passed away this past week, I wasn't entirely sure the nature of the relationship between Rocky and his son, of course, The Rock, Dwayne Johnson. I always thought that maybe they had some sort of estranged relationship, which you kind of project that just based on how the pro wrestling business is. I mean, who has a friendship or a father-son relationship or what have you that is strong in just given the way that the business is set up? And I'm glad to kind of hear that, yeah, Rocky trained his son, and they seem to have a very good father-son relationship. I don't know how much of it is the fact that Dwayne is so good at, you know, just kind of talking to the media and making everything sound like it's okay. But it did seem like they had a very good bond with them. And just learning more about Rocky Johnson, you know, not just through this podcast, because he was a star in various territories, not only here in the WWF, where he and Atlas were the first African-American tag team champions, which I guess he was most proud of anything in his career, but he was also a star in other places, such as Memphis. I believe I covered an episode of Memphis Wrestling where he was there from May of 87. Not sure he was actually on the episode. He started wrestling at a very early age, and just learning about his early life, where he's from Canada, and that should not go unmentioned, because that means that The Rock himself is actually half Canadian. So, you know, he's got dual citizenship from being the son of a Canadian citizen and an American citizen. But this story of Rocky Johnson's childhood just absolutely blows my mind, and I can't picture myself in the same position surviving the way he did. The year is 1957. It's Christmas up in Canada. Rocky Johnson is a lad of 13 years old. And here's the story that Dwayne tells. That Christmas, my dad's mom had her new boyfriend over for Christmas dinner. Her boyfriend got drunk and pissed on the turkey. My dad went outside, got a shovel, and drew a line in the snow and said, "If you cross that line, I'll kill you." The drunk crossed it, and my dad laid him out cold as a block of ice. In front of the entire family, my dad's mom looked at him and said, "Get out." Cops were called. They told my dad's mom that when her boyfriend regains consciousness, he's going to kill your son, so one of them has got to go. In front of the entire family, my dad's mom looked at him and said, "Get out." He was 13 years old and now homeless. That effed up true story happened in Amherst, Nova Scotia, Canada in 1954. So I guess it's 54 instead of 57. It did say he would have been 13 in 1957. Point is, that's pretty damn crazy. To be a 13-year-old, you know, person of color, I don't care if you're in Canada or the United States, that's some pretty tough sledding. And the immediate comparison that I drew is to Roddy Piper, also a Canadian, also started wrestling at an extremely young age. Rocky Johnson started at the age of 16, around the same age, that is, that Piper would have. So, you know, just to see these stories, it's just absolutely insane, because that's something I don't think would ever happen in the modern era. I do find it a little curious, and there's probably some background that I'm not privy to, where Rocky's mother went with the dude who pissed in the turkey on Christmas. Like, really? Like, that's what you're going to go with? I mean, this isn't like the Bumpus's dogs running in and tearing apart the turkey because there isn't good fencing between the houses. This is a man who unbuckled, presuming he wore a belt, pulled down his pants, maybe just his fly, whipped out his Johnson, no pun intended, and pissed on a Christmas turkey that was to be the dinner for everybody there. It's just really, really screwed up story as relayed by Dwayne The Rock Johnson. And Rocky does start in this one along with Ron Shaw. And Rocky grabs a hammerlock and quick tag to Atlas. So you're going to see a lot of quick tags in this match with him and Atlas and SD Jones. And it's just kind of a chain ongoing early on with the quick tags. And Rocky gets back in, hits a shoulder block, drop down, and then an arm drag. And this match moves actually pretty fast for 1984 WWF. And they do take a little bit of a break. Not a commercial break, but 1984, they're still taking mail from the fans and just kind of reading it out on air, and we get a fan from the nation's capital weighing in.
Well, that's a very interesting piece of correspondence originating from Tracy Burns in our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Dear Vincent Jean, former World Wrestling Federation champ Bob Backlund should be applauded for his consistent work with the youth of our country. He's the most giving and unselfish professional wrestler I've ever seen. How many years has Bob Backlund been involved with kids wrestling leagues and tournaments? That particular letter from Tracy Burns, Washington, D.C.
Well, of course, Mr. Backlund has been involved for a long, long time in his endeavors, supporting Bob Backlund's kids league and indeed supporting all amateur wrestling.
Now, calling him the most giving would come as a surprise to those who are critics of Backlund's title reign, or at least the matches therein, where, well, he gobbles up too much of the offense, and he swallows whoever heel he's in there with, Hull. But no, I know, it's a completely different thing. And we actually hear from him a little bit later. Yeah, Backlund, he is not gone. I mean, he kind of lays low for a couple of months in early 84, in January and February, once Hogan wins the title. But he does reemerge here, and it is a bit strange. And as I mentioned, he was on that Boston Garden show, and we're going to hear a promo from him on the Madison Square Garden show that is upcoming. SD Jones working over Tony Colon. Colon finally tags out to John Callahan, a guy who, when he appeared on the January 7th Championship Wrestling, I wrote about this on my blog a long time ago. I know that's not online anymore, but John Callahan looks like the Undertaker's unsuccessful younger brother who really wanted to be an accountant, but he got pushed into wrestling because that's what his brother did. But his hair here, he kind of looks more like the it's like 2002, 2003 Booger Red Undertaker. It's really, really strange how I'm kind of connecting those dots between those two particular people. And Callahan actually misses a charge into the corner. SD was out of the ring. It would have been funny if SD Jones had gotten out of the way of a charge finally after him missing them for all these years. A side headlock, but Rocky, who was in there, tags out and kind of holds him. Actually, Rocky was in the side headlock, and he held on to the man to keep him from getting away out of the corner. So pretty smart, pretty good psychology there. But Colon, on the other side, is able to tag in. Like I said, a lot of tags in this match. But Tony Atlas beats his ass for a second. Now SD gets in there. Yeah, SD is wearing the blue trunks. He's looking very different from the other guys. Now Rocky, he gets in there. He ends up in trouble very briefly, but then he tags out to SD Jones. You get a backdrop and then a bell ringer as the Soul Patrol hit a double backdrop, and that only gets a two count. I believe it was on Tony Colon, as we hear from Gene and Vince that the first inductee into Sergeant Slaughter's Cobra Corps is coming up in the form of Private Terry Daniel. So save my thoughts on that for a little bit later, as SD moves Colon back towards his own corner so that he can tag Callahan. And I'm just really scratching my head here. It's like they haven't taken enough punishment on the other side. It's like they get these frequent tags. And hell, even Callahan is able to tag out to Ron Shaw. And I'm just wondering, how many freaking tags are these guys going to get? I've talked about enhancement tag teams, and you figure, all right, we got a six-man. Each guy's going to get in the ring once. Maybe one of them will get in twice. Maybe two of them will get in there twice. But they've done like 9 to 12 tags here. What the hell is going on? But Atlas now headbutts Shaw, but he headbutts him into Tony Colon, so now he gets in there, and he gets press slammed to the mat. Impressive move for 1984. Atlas goes over and tags SD Jones, who just runs in and pins him to end this very strange match. So SD just takes the tag like, oh, is he going to hit his finisher? Well, I don't even know what SD Jones' finisher would be. No, instead, he pulls the Mr. Perfect at the 1988 Survivor Series and just comes in, goes for the cover, knowing that he can get it, and he picks up the win that way. What a freaking bizarre match with about 28 tags between the two teams as an enhancement match on television. But all I know is if you got a problem with it, write to the World Wrestling Federation at Wrestling, P.O. Box 1538, Greenwich, Connecticut, 06836. And for you completists out there who must know who has that P.O. Box now, according to the internets, it is the law firm of Robinson & Cole, LLP.
It takes a permanent change in four key areas: appetite, attitude, thought patterns, and most important, willpower. Diets can't help you with these, but hypnosis can. That's why over 500,000 people have turned to the Institute of Hypnotherapy for weight loss and freedom from the addiction of smoking. To find out how you can enroll in their low-cost, no-risk group sessions, call 1-800-645-4910.
I think my only experience with hypnosis was I was in the audience for a Frank Santos show at Babson College back in probably 1998 or 99, and he was known as the R-rated hypnotist, so I don't think they're talking about the same thing. So you want to lose weight, I have an idea, and this has actually worked for me these past couple of weeks, although there's certainly some mitigating circumstances. Eat less, think about what you're eating, and for God's sakes, drink less booze and beer. I actually called that 800 number just to see what would happen, and it was amazing in that it would take you from one scam to another. It would offer you free roadside assistance, blah, blah, blah. Then you'd hit pound, like, oh, I'm not interested in that. And then it would offer you $100 shopping certificates, which is a weird turn of phrase. Usually it's gift certificates. It's just one ad after another. It's like, it was so hilarious. It's like, cable? Addiction treatment centers? What do you want? I mean, like, why are you calling this number? Is what it should have said after a certain period. So now we get our promos for the upcoming April 23rd MSG show. And this is Gene Okerlund hanging out by the ring. There's no studio as there would be later in 1984. So we learn it'll be Tito Santana defending the Intercontinental title against, quote, one of the Samoans. And as we learned earlier, as I told you earlier, it would be J.J. Dillon filling in. But we got Bob Backlund, and he's looking a little bit different because he's got a black satin jacket, knowing that he knows what the trends are here in the 80s, and he wants to look badass. There ain't nothing more badass than a black satin jacket. He's main eventing B shows of sorts around this time, smaller towns, and for when, you know, Hogan is not there. He's going to be facing his old rival from 1981, Greg Valentine, on the MSG show. But it is kind of interesting to hear Bob Backlund, several months removed, 3.5 months removed from losing the WWF title to the Iron Sheik, and all the circumstances where he doesn't get the rematch at MSG, Hogan gets the title, and now he's out of the picture. So it's just interesting to hear him talk, because he's only got 4 months left, and not a whole lot of TV appearances between now and then.
I'm just as excited as anybody about this one. You know, I got a lot to prove. We got a count out last time. I felt Greg Valentine snuck out of the ring a couple times, but this is going to be a definitely winner in it. I've been doing a lot of traveling around New York City, meeting a lot of people over at the Veterans Hospital with the Special Olympics, and a lot of good things happening. People coming up to me and saying, champ, go get them. And it's been 4 months since I had the WWF title, and to have that name branded on you, it's really proud, because sometimes it's not all the things you do in the ring that mean so much. It's the things you do out of the ring and how you carry yourself. We're going to be proud. You people in New York City, be proud of your name. Be proud of your city. Be proud of your country. Take care of your friends. You people are my friends, and I'm going to do my darndest. I'm not going to let any of us down. I'm going to represent you people. I'm going to represent your children as proudly as I can. And, you know, all of them wishing me a lot of luck.
I know what...
Boy, that makes me feel happy. You know, a lot of the kids like to touch me on the head now and say, good luck. And I touch them back, and I say, study hard in school.
I know sometimes you're a little awkward, Bob, but for the love of God, please do not admit to touching kids. I know what you meant in this case, but somebody could take that out of context and do real harm with it. Okay? Just don't say that again. Gene Okerlund and Bob Backlund, a really strange combo together. Is Okerlund comes in the second Backlund loses the title, and then, you know, they overlap by about 7 months. But then by the time Backlund reemerges in late 92, Oakland's going to be gone. So it's not like you see a lot of interaction between those two guys, even though they cover a lot of ground, you know, in WWF history from like 77 all the way through. And then when Backlund returns, Backlund actually defeated Valentine in that match. 26 minutes and 5 seconds. So they certainly gave them plenty of time. Now, up next, we get Sergeant Slaughter. And guess what? He's not a real sergeant. Oh, no. A professional wrestler was not exactly what he said he was. It's next thing you know, Duke Drozzi, not an actual sanitation worker. IRS, not a real tax agent. So when he slaps you with an audit, it's all entirely fake. It's fake, I tell you. I really hope somebody wins a Pulitzer Prize for blowing the lid off this story. I'm getting very emotional about it. Now, the feud with the Iron Sheik is just perfect timing, like I've said. They timed the Sergeant Slaughter turning babyface so perfectly in 1984 to capitalize on kind of the rise of patriotism. Say what you want about the Reagan era, but you know, in terms of business, dollars and cents for the World Wrestling Federation, it was timed perfectly because of, yes, he actually started a provocative move towards the Iranian guy and started a war. When would we ever see that again?
When you talk about sports, you think of New York City. When you talk about Madison Square Garden, you think about wrestling. When I sit in the locker rooms, I can hear the ghost of past wrestlers, of all the things. I can hear the crowds screaming and hollering. You can tell when you walk in Madison Square Garden, you're the elite. You're the number one hot shows in wrestling. In sports. How many times does Madison Square Garden rumble with the 25,000 people that they can jam in there? And Iron Sheik, you and I are going to be going head to head. We've had a battle already. Once on television, once on the island. And now it's coming to Manhattan, Madison Square Garden, the place where all the battles have started and most of them have ended. I know the war is not over, Iron Sheik, but this time I'm not taking any prisoners.
It's funny that you mentioned the elite in Madison Square Garden, given that last year the Young Bucks and Kenny Omega actually ended their relationships with ROH and New Japan, so they weren't on the MSG show, and they call themselves the elite. That's going to make my Rusty Brooks sound towards that one. I can't wait for one of those aspiring wrestling journalists to write the story exposing that there aren't actually real ghosts at Madison Square Garden. They could bring in Ghostbusters for that one. Maybe reach out to Winston, see what he has to say about the entire thing. Bottom line is, I can't really be bothered to care about a story like this. I mean, there's plenty else in the world to worry about where I don't really care about a person who was portraying a character. Even if he was discussing it in out-of-character interviews, that's just the way professional wrestling has been for, like, years and years and years. And it's not going to change because somebody writes an article trying to cancel Sergeant Slaughter. It's not like you're hearing from Sergeant Slaughter a whole hell of a lot these days anyway, unless you're actively seeking out Sergeant Slaughter content in the year 2020. And it's not as if he's one of those Nazis who fled Germany after World War II and resided in South America. This isn't like some sort of Nazi hunt. All right, that's all I have to say about that, because we got a little bit of fun in the form of Captain Lou Albano, who's with Greg Valentine. A very odd combination, but I've spoken about how Valentine, like, test drove every manager, like, that was in the company, except for Slick. He was never with Slick, although that pairing would not have made a lot of sense, given that Valentine really couldn't dance, as we learned from the Rhythm and Blues experiment. But Captain Lou uses one of the old Bobby Heenan tropes that you'd hear from him occasionally.
Get ready on the 23rd. Come on in, Captain Lou Albano.
Do you think that helmet's putting too much pressure on the brain of the Sarge? I mean, he seems to talk a little bit, I don't know. Let's talk about Bob Backlund. Let's talk about this match, brother. Last time, both men were counted out. But you saw the films, Gene. We were ahead on points. Now there'll be no question I will film the match in entirety. This man, Greg Hammer-Valentine, will be our winner.
Somebody loved that Albano line about being ahead of points because you can actually hear laughter off camera. I don't know who that is. It's definitely not Vince because that's not one of his laughs.
Yes, I do. You've got to respect the man. Captain Lou Albano respects him. A man that held the world championship for 5 or 6 years has got to be the greatest athlete of all time. But right now, he doesn't have that world championship. And right now, Bobby Backlund, the main thing is we're going to find out who is the better man. It's going to be one-on-one, no outside interference. This time I promise the people of Madison Square Garden, the city of New York, that there will be a winner. There will be a decisive winner this time.
As I mentioned earlier, Bob Backlund was the decisive winner in that match because while he was certainly de-emphasized, it's not like they sent him tumbling down the card. He's still beating guys or at least doing time limit draws. You get to that weird thing in the summer where he's facing other baby faces and they're going to time limit draws. That's a little weird. Also, in kind of the odd category, Madison Square Garden shows I always thought started at 8 p.m., this show on the Monday night starts at 9 p.m.
Hello there, New Yorkers. I'm Greg Nettles, your ex-Yankee captain and brand new author. Get a head start on my new book in this Sunday's Daily News, where I take a few cuts at, well, you know the reason I'm now a Padre. See you at Shea.
Oh, it's good being a millionaire. And now, thanks to the Daily News new Millionaire's Roulette game, you could be one too. Would you like to start fiddling around?
The eyes, the ears, the honest voice of New York, the Daily News.
This commercial fascinates me because it references what was then a current event in New York sports, an advertisement for the New York Daily News. Greg Nettles was a third baseman in Major League Baseball for a very long time, primarily for the Yankees, for which he played 10 or 11 years. He was on the World Series teams, champions in 77 and 78. And the story of how he ended up getting dealt to the Padres, I was not aware of any of this because it was a little before my time. In the fall of 1982, George Steinbrenner, Yankees owner, stated that Nettles is in the twilight of his career. And if he never plays another game for me, he has earned more than what I have paid him. This comment insulted Nettles and led to his increased dissatisfaction with the Yankees. The Yankees acquired Toby Hara, a nice palindrome and also an infielder, in February of 1984, intending to platoon him with Nettles at third base. Dissatisfied with that, Nettles reported spring training at the deadline for his arrival. On March 30th, 1984, the Yankees traded Nettles to the San Diego Padres for Dennis Rasmussen and a player to be named later. Nettles had wanted to play closer to his San Diego home, and his approval of the trade was required given his years of service. Major League Baseball, if you play 10 years overall and the last 5 with the same team, your permission is required for any trade. Nettles famously characterized his career with the Yankees when he said that, quote, "When I was a little boy, I wanted to be a baseball player and join the circus. With the Yankees, I have accomplished both." Good line by Greg Nettles. There's also a commercial for Ocean Pacific, which is totally one of those 80s clothing line, sort of the surf apparel is what I was trying to get at.
I'm in the corner to my left from Nashville. It is Dr. D. David Schultz. I'm the partner from Tampa, Florida. Weighing in at 262 pounds, it is Mr. Wonderful, Paul Orndorff.
I tried calling, but they don't have a listing for Mr. Wonderful.
What spelling did you use?
I am pleased to report that we are back in Allentown for this match for some reason, but it's got Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff and Dr. D. David Schultz, the latter who I love, but I've said everything about Paul Orndorff that I could possibly say at this point. Hell, I'm even reusing that gag from Caddyshack with I couldn't find a listing for a Mr. Wonderful. I've played that on a previous show. They're facing off against Johnny Rivera and Francisco Vasquez. I mean, what wisdom can I possibly impart at this point with these guys, other than Roddy Piper is at ringside with them because you get that short-lived triumvirate before they basically cast Dr. D out because he didn't really fit in with the other two guys. I mean, Orndorff is in a tag team at this point, and they did get title shots against Tony Atlas and Rocky Johnson. I mean, what can I really say about this guy at this point? He's not so high where, like, they keep him off TV to keep him scarce like Hogan, but he doesn't stink enough where, like, he's not on TV very often. So, like, every show that I've done from, like, 84 to 87, he's on there every freaking time. And Orndorff actually struggles for a second, but then he hits a knee to the gut on Rivera. Dr. D gets in, and as because he's such a good sport, he lets Rivera tag out to Vasquez, or maybe that's how they organize the tag matches, is one guy pairs up with one guy, and then the other guy pairs up with a different guy. And he pretty quickly hits a back elbow, and he almost falls out of the ring when he hits the ropes, Vasquez, and Dr. D just puts him away with that diving elbow off the second rope where he kind of twists his body. I mean, what an odd team. Not that, you know, it's two heels at roughly the same level at this point, but it seems to me that Dr. D and Orndorff are effectively just the temporary number two heel team, still considering Wild Samoans number one because they were the most recent tag team champions. Dick Murdoch and Adrian Adonis, they came in as part of that wave at the St. Louis tapings, but at this point, they have Japan commitments because Vince is still allowing that sort of thing. And yes, Murdoch and Adonis are in Japan for much of the months of March and May. So during those time periods, you need another tag team to challenge Johnson and Atlas on house shows. So you can just throw together Orndorff and Dr. D, and that is seemingly what they did in this case. And hey, I made it through a Paul Orndorff segment again. Yay!
The views expressed in Piper's Pit, those of Rowdy Roddy Piper himself and those of his guests, and not necessarily those of us here on the World Wrestling Federation Network. With that in mind, we take you now to Piper's Pit.
It does seem strange by any standard that in one of the first Piper's Pit, because it's only been on for less than 3 months at this point, that Roddy Piper would have Frank Williams, longtime enhancement talent, as his guest. This would be like the equivalent of when Jimmy Fallon took over The Tonight Show, him booking, I don't know, Emily Schulman, the nosy neighbor girl Harriet from the TV show Small Wonder, booking her as a guest in the year 2014 or whatever year Fallon took over that show. It just seems a little odd. However, there is a certain method to the madness, as we'll see getting to the end of this. Just the history of Piper's Pit up to this point. The first one I covered in that January 28, 84 championship wrestling, which was on the Piper's Pit set, although I guess technically it was called Victory Corner with Robert DeBoard, and then Piper kind of took over. But I consider it the first one because the set is the Piper's Pit set. And his guests along the way since then. Sometimes he would do only one, and it would be played on both shows, like in this case. Other times you'd have one for Championship Wrestling and one for All-Stars, so you'd get two different ones. But a lot of them are pretty boring. Here's the guest list as we've gone along. Paul Orndorff, Dr. D. David Schultz, so two of his cronies. Eddie Gilbert. And file that one under sounds better than it actually was, because this is very young Eddie Gilbert who hadn't really found himself yet. Tony Garea, Mr. Fuji and Tiger Chung Lee, Mass Superstar, Tito Santana, Tonga Kid, B. Bryant Blair and Tony Garea, Andre the Giant, that one was kind of interesting. Jimmy Snuka the first time, this is the one where Piper was kind of insulting him and not letting him talk, but no coconut. Sheik, Iron Sheik, and Freddie Blassie. Mr. Wonderful was on a second time. And an in-uniform Terry Daniels, the private, and Ivan Putski. And I think I know where that one went. So, Frank Williams, he kind of stands out from the rest of those guys. I mean, yeah, Tony Garea was, you know, fading into kind of enhancement level, but that guy was a 5-time tag team champion of the world, for God's sakes. So Frankie, he's there, and he did have wins in the late 70s. I mean, this guy is not a complete zero. It's just that he hadn't really won since like 1981 or something. And he's a loser on TV on a weekly basis. You could even say that, you know, Beck wrote that song in 1994 about him. Except for the fact that Frank Williams was done after 1984 and he passed away either 91 or 92. I've actually seen it in both years. He died of a heart attack. So Roddy Piper and Frank Williams, do they have any prior history with this? And yes, as a matter of fact, they had a match at Madison Square Garden in December, January of 1979. That show aired on the MSG Network, apparently, but I cannot find any copies of it, so I was not able to watch the Piper-Frank Williams match. So this segment was taped on the 27th in Allentown, but at the taping in Hamburg the next day was when Jimmy Snuka and the Coconut, it was done at that time, and only aired in the St. Louis market, in a rather odd decision for on its face, until, well, you realize that they were doing it to hype the match in the St. Louis market, and they held it off, I think because they didn't want to do it elsewhere until, you know, much later on as you get into the summer. So this is really kind of the first seminal Piper's Pit, one of the ones that everybody remembers that gets replayed for years and years and years. And, the fact that it's Frank Williams on here is just insane. So the first question you have to ask yourself is, why Frank Williams, Roddy?
Being the kind of person that I am, and I like to give everybody a fair break. What I'm doing out of the kindness of my heart, I have a gentleman here named Frank Williams. Frank Williams, first of all, I don't know where you come from.
I'm from Columbus, Ohio.
From Columbus, Ohio. I've wrestled in Columbus, Ohio. I've never lost a match in Columbus, Ohio. Have you ever lost a match?
Yeah.
One of the reasons why I love doing this show at this point in time is because I can actually get answers to questions like that. Did Roddy Piper ever lose a match in Columbus, Ohio? Because clearly it's racing through my head. I am fact-checking the man, yes. I want to see if this is a false or misleading statement. Now, if this was the year 2000, how the hell am I going to find that? There's no sort of results portal online, at least that I knew of at the time. And you think, okay, well, the WWF, he hasn't been there that long. How often do they go to Columbus, Ohio? Not really that frequently. So who was going to Columbus, Ohio? Georgia Championship Wrestling actually had a presence in Ohio, which I've always thought was kind of funny because the two states are not really near each other. I think it has to do with the fact that they were just on TV there, and that goes a long way. When Piper was in Georgia, 1982. And as a matter of fact, he had five matches there. He beat Bob Armstrong by DQ, lost to Dick Slater by DQ, lost alongside Ole Anderson against Dusty Rhodes and Tommy Rich, and he defeated the Super Destroyer and the Mass Superstar. So a 3-2 record, not bad. However, to say he had never lost, well, I guess he might mean I never got pinned or submitted. I'm guessing that Ole must have eaten the pinfall in that tag match against Dusty and Rich. And then the DQ to Slater, obviously, those don't count. One thing that kind of strikes me with the Piper's Pit set is you got the two guys sitting down in chairs, just kind of like ordinary chairs, and it almost looks like their knees are touching. Like it's that scene in Mad Men where Pete Campbell is getting hit on by Bob Benson. Anyway, I really like that scene, and I was going to look for any excuse to bring that up. Even though I don't think their knees are touching, it's a pretty close call. I mean, we could put this to video review. So Piper's never lost a match. He's going to get all up in Frank Williams' face because here's a man that is literally what he does for a living. And for him to be like, oh, I never lose a match, it's almost like Piper is shooting on his unwillingness to actually lose matches, which would become a thing which he was doing in order to protect his character, which, amazingly enough, it actually works when you protect your character. So anyway, he's going to antagonize Frankie until he can't take no more.
See, it seems odd to me when you're talking about fighting careers and a career like myself. I went on the premise of never having to lose a match. I've never lost a match in my whole career. I've had different things happen to me, but I have never actually lost a match because I figured once you were defeated one time, that it would take that oomph away from you that you needed. Yourself, you're just the opposite. I have never seen you win a match in my whole career of watching you, and I've seen you've been around. You've fought some tremendous fighters. I've seen what you've done, but you lack the guts. You lack the authority to go in there. You lack the guts, and when you're against the ropes, what you do is instead of going after a man, you just back off from him. Maybe a little cowardism. Maybe what you do, maybe you should be making pizzas.
I'm not a coward of nobody. I'm not afraid of nobody. Otherwise, I won't
wait
be.
Wait a second.
Now, you may have heard a little thump there when Frankie Williams had started talking. That is him grabbing the microphone away from Piper and kind of screwing it up where he pulls it away with such force he actually hits himself in either the mouth or nose with it. Creates that sound effect. Oh, poor Frankie. This is his big moment and something's still got to go wrong. But yeah, Piper has been giving it to him, and he's upset. You know, he tries his best, but Piper says, "Well, you know, this is not supposed to be a physical confrontation." Until, of course, it is.
This is verbal. This is not physical. Pizzas or something like that. Maybe.
I said I'm not afraid of nobody. I'm always inside ring, no matter what. I got no room for nobody.
You got no room for nobody. That's a wonderful thing. You got no room for nobody, but you're a lousy wrestler. It's as simple as that.
I might be a lousy wrestler, but I'm still in there. I'm not afraid of nobody.
Piper hammering away. Oh, no. Piper all over Frank Williams. Puck. Unbelievable. It's simple as this. Oh. Oh, no. Oh. That's incredible.
Oh.
They got the answers. I changed the question.
This is like the first real physical thing Piper has done in the WWF. Yeah, he's had matches, but when he comes in, he's a manager in an attempt to allow him to heal some injuries that dated back to Jim Crockett Promotions. I'm thinking Starrcade 83 when he loses the hearing in the dog collar chain match against Valentine. And to establish the character like this, he hadn't done this for this audience before, where he's just unpredictable and crazy. Yeah, it was a lot of talk previous to this, but here he beats up this poor guy who is just trying to defend himself and to defend his honor, if you will. And this is so great in terms of building that Roddy Piper character to where it needs to be. And that part at the end of, like, when they think they got the answers, I change the questions. That's all done off mic. So I'm glad that the camera was able to pick that up, because he actually hit Frank Williams with the microphone shortly before that. Poor Frankie. But then again, this is the story of his career. He sacrificed himself to get something over. And for all the matches that this guy ever had, he's just forever going to be remembered for an interview segment he did in the last year of his career.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, the next contest, set for one fall with a 10-minute time limit, introducing in the corner to my left, from Comanche, Texas, weighing 275 pounds, here is Johnny Ringo, and his opponent from Amarillo, Texas, weighing in at 220 pounds, making his first appearance in this arena, here is Terry Daniels.
The beauty of playing that whole thing, other than being able to hear Johnny Ringo, I can't roll my R's like Joe McHugh, is that he says what's the next match, and it saves me from having to tell you what the next match is. even though there's probably more effort and cutting and pasting it into Audacity. Yeah, it's Private Terry Daniels against Johnny Ringo up next. The new Jim Nelson is what Terry Daniels is. This is the flip side of what we saw in that Mid-Atlantic episode I did several weeks ago, where Jim Nelson, the future Boris Zukov, came back for revenge against Sergeant Slaughter. Well, in an earlier Mid-Atlantic episode, he was the private under Sergeant Slaughter when he was a heel over there and eventually turned against him. Here, Terry Daniels, they're the patriotic baby faces, and Terry Daniels had kind of been the lackey to this point, holding the flag outside the ring for Sergeant Slaughter matches. That's how he ended up on Piper's Pit that one time that I referenced earlier. So this is a Cobra Corps, Sergeant Slaughter stable that didn't really go anywhere because they referred to Daniels as the first member of the Cobra Corps, but then I don't recall them ever adding another member. It's really kind of funny. It's like when Ned Flanders goes and gets the season pass to the apple orchard and the number on it is 00001 and you can't imagine why anybody else would do it. So, Terry Daniels, he's a real Marine who actually got into trouble for using the actual uniform outside of the course of the duty of being a Marine. So, I don't know if anybody won a Pulitzer for that. Probably not, but that was the Marines just kind of coming down on him. The problem is, he's got the personality of a dead moth, which is probably why the Cobra Corps just kind of ended from there. And in case you're wondering, that reference, the dead moth, and where you've heard that before. Yes, that is from the movie Dirty Work, which I watched over the weekend. It's in the scene that Don Rickles is coming up with insult. He insults Artie Lang for like 3 minutes, and then he's got the one for Norm. And I swear what they did was he had all these insults for Norm MacDonald, but Norm couldn't keep a straight face, so he had to just keep it as vanilla as possible.
So there you are, Tubby. Ah, you look like a bucket of lard on a bad day. You baby gorilla. Why don't you work a zoo and stop bothering people? Got a call yesterday from Baskin-Robbins. They said that they're down to only 5 flavors. You're swelling up as I talk to you. Look at you. How's this? How's it doing? Hello, ice cream. Having a good time? Running around? What are you laughing at? Because I called your friend a fat pig, huh? You think that's funny?
Oh, no, I was just laughing earlier when you were talking to his belly.
Why you get a horse and live in the mountains someplace and don't bother anybody? Got a personality like a dead moth.
I mean, this is a Private Terry Daniels match. He didn't do a whole lot interesting in the WWF. He did have a match probably on Championship Wrestling against the Iron Sheik where he got his ass kicked and Sergeant Slaughter ran in for the DQ. I mean, he reemerges in 1989. I actually was watching that primetime wrestling. I probably mentioned it earlier, where he's facing off against the Widowmaker in a rather interesting bout. But come on, what is more interesting, Terry Daniels talk or me talking about Dirty Work? One part of that movie that I noticed this weekend that I love quite a bit is when Norm, he's referring back to his childhood. The character's name is Mitch. And he's crossing the street and he decided to put glue on his ass because the crossing guard would... The crossing guard was touching the kids as they crossed the street, and by putting glue on there, he ensured that the crossing guard's hand would be stuck to his ass. But then, when he's announcing what's happening to everybody around, letting them know what's happening, it's this 8-9-year-old kid, but he's doing it in like the perfect Norm MacDonald voice.
Like, there was this crossing guard who used to grab all the kids' asses. Back then, people weren't on the lookout for that kind of thing. The only way to nail a guy like that was to catch him red-handed. That's where the super glue came in.
Hey, look, everybody! Crossing guard grabbing 8-year-old's ass over here! Look, everybody! Look! Crossing guard grabbing 8-year-old's ass over here!
Frankly, I could just sit here and talk about Dirty Work all day and just keep playing clips, but I have to get through this match and get to the rest of the show. A lot of amateur stuff early with Daniels, a slow-ass backdrop that was basically done in slow motion, not very good by either guy. A slam of Fat Ringo is actually mildly impressive because he's not exactly the slimmest guy in the room. And Ringo gets a backdrop, but a flash sunset flip gets the win for Private Terry Daniels. A rather unimpressive victory to the point where he ends up getting the treatment that I was giving superstar Billy Graham for a while, where I just will talk about anything else to just avoid discussing this match. However, there is an interesting thing after the match, because Sergeant Slaughter is there with Daniels, and as they walk to the back, they have a meeting, like, kind of out in the open. And it almost seems like Slaughter is preparing for his future career as a road agent, but is just doing it out in front of everybody.
You get him down and you grab him, get all the weight behind your back like that. Well, you know, when you go down, then you won't have to do any more push-ups.
Yes, sir.
If you do that again, you're going to be doing some push-ups. You understand?
Yes, sir.
All right. Left face, right face. Forward. Put. One, two, one, two, one.
Sergeant Slaughter. A little last-minute advice there for Terry Daniels.
This isn't even a formal military exercise, so I'm surprised Daniels didn't just, like, go off on Slaughter, who is not technically his commanding officer, unless there's some sort of weird Cobra Corps contract that he signed. Like, he could have just gone off and, like, hey, old man, you're not even a real Marine like I am. You never even... Ugh, but then again, you know... There's a reason why he was a real Marine. It's because he had discipline that probably I wouldn't have.
Fact, 1982 and 83 combined, over 40 million jeans will be purchased by Macho Man and Miss Woman. Jeans with body language, subliminals, and expression. When contemplating a chain, be sure it has enough gold firing class. Like these chains, especially designed by Santo. This beautiful genuine set consists of our $30 ravishing gold nugget-style necklace, plus our $20 matching elaborate double-strand gold nugget bracelet.
I love to think back of those commercials in the 80s when I was 9 years old, knowing that it was a complete scam. Oh yeah, we're just giving away $200 worth of gold for $19.95 plus shipping and handling, whatever the hell that is. Like, I could sniff that out as a scam, but I couldn't quite figure out and grasp the pro wrestling thing at that point in time. So up next is our feature bout for WWF All-Star Hulk Hogan, the reigning WWF champion now for a couple of months, taking on Samoan number one, which would be AFA. Now, I had mentioned earlier on how on All-Star Wrestling, you don't see Gary Michael Capetta, the ring announcer, because they were editing him out. I have my theory as to why that was, being that he worked in other promotions as well. But here, this is one of the situations, like what I said earlier, where you can't edit him out. You can't do a thing where, oh, the world champion is already in the ring, and he's, you know, come out to Eye of the Tiger, but we're not going to air that because we want to spite Gary Michael Capetta or something.
And ladies and gentlemen, his opponent from Venice Beach, California, weighing 305 pounds, he is the current World Wrestling Federation heavyweight champion, the incredible Hulk Hogan!
All right, the Hulkster! Look at that physique, up 303 pounds.
Apparently Vince wasn't listening to Capetta because he was announced at 305 pounds. Very unusual. I don't think I've ever heard Hogan announced at that weight. I should probably keep an Excel file of Hogan's announced weights by, you know, the date of the match. Usually, for most of the run, it's 302. Sometimes, I think in 89, it went to 303. But 305, that's one that I'd never actually heard that one. I filed that away for the Hulkamania Department of Weights and Measures, brother. And he's wearing the yellow and red Hulkamania shirt that would be commonplace on him for the next 4 years. I didn't think that came until later, because you had the one from the January 84 MSG show that says, like, Hulk-a-mania, and it's kind of like one of the ones you can get made at the mall back in those days. Then he's got the white American made shirt that he wore for 85 and 86, but he still wore the Hulkamania shirt on a lot of occasions. And the last I remember him wearing that was the WrestleMania 4. And then when he comes back, it's Hulk rules. And I remember being like resentful as a young fan that, like, oh, he doesn't wear the Hulkamania shirt anymore. And this is the earliest I saw him wearing it. But yeah, as a 9-year-old, I was apparently bothered by Hogan not wearing the Hulkamania shirt anymore. Probably because I had Hulk rules. It's not as fun. Like, Hulkamania is a nice, you know, term that was coined and created. And also referenced in the unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt to hilarious effect. Saying she's just getting over her case of Hulkamania or whatever the hell it was. It's been a little bit since I've seen that show. There was some kid in the aisle in Hamburg. As Hogan's come to the ring, he like has to like pick him up and like move him to the side. Like he's JT Snow rescuing Dusty Baker's kid in the 2002 World Series when he like wandered too close to home plate as the play was still going on. Hogan entrances, as far as they go, I saw one from, I think it was May or June of 85, might have actually been April, where he's teaming with Orndorff against Orton and Piper, and that crowd is just insane, and like he could barely get through, and in fact they tore his t-shirt right off. He didn't even get to do it himself. So Hogan, in those early years, definitely with some crazy entrances back when the security wasn't quite up to par. Hogan, his career against the Samoans is kind of interesting because he faces Sika on the October 87 Saturday Night's Main Event, a match which I remember mostly for Vince McMahon saying that Sika is a consummate savage, one of my all-time favorite Vince McMahon lines. But let us not forget, the Samoans were surrounding Bob Backlund on the January 7th 84 Championship Wrestling, and that's how Hogan made his return to the arena in Allentown, was coming out to help Bob Backlund when he was in a tough spot. Since I am fond of discussing the Hulk Hogan uniform system, i.e. the trunks and knee pad color, he is in the traditional yellow and red, the yellow trunks with the red knee pad. So, you know, he's mixing it up through 87. June of 87 is the last time you see him in anything but what he's wearing here. Another oddity about this one is this was not on the same taping as the rest of the Hamburg matches that aired on this show, and it was not taped in Allentown either, obviously, because we heard Capetta. It was taped March 7th in Hamburg, so it was part of the previous taping cycle. Now, on the other show, it was Hogan against Tiger Chung Lee, which I know it was very hard for me to pass that up, but there's actually multiple shows with Hogan versus Tiger Chung Lee. I know that there's an All-Star, might have been Championship Wrestling, but I think it was All-Star from the summer of 85, where Hogan just turns up and faces Chunger out of nowhere. One of the things that I'm least proud of, having done 152 episodes of this podcast, is the time I was running down Hulk Hogan matches from 1984 that appeared on TV, and me leaving out like 5 or 6 of them. That was rather embarrassing. That was a real lapse in my research. So Hogan, he tosses Afa on the initial lockup, but then Afa catches him. But then he puts his head down, a cardinal mistake for a ring veteran. Hogan gets the boot in on him, an atomic drop and a slam of the large Samoan. Now Sika and Captain Lou Albano still managing the Wild Samoans up on the apron. They don't turn on him until Adonis and Murdoch win the titles, and all of a sudden, well, now you need a babyface team to go against them. So the Wild Samoans, who are winding down at this point, Afa's last full year in the WWF is 84, they become a babyface team, and Captain Lou actually follows right at the end of the year when Piper hits him over the head with that gold record or whatever the hell it was. Clothesline and a big leg drop by Hogan. It feels like almost like a squash match where he just rolls over Afa. Just very interesting to see, completely dominant performance. But now Captain Lou, he gets caught in the ring. And Hogan hits him with a right hand. And Albano, while of the three wise men, sometimes he gets on my nerves. He can also be really, really funny. And he's so friggin' comical with the way that he's selling for Hogan. It's incredible.
Oh, what a spectacle.
Oh, look at this.
Wait a minute.
Look at this.
Powder rider.
Oh.
Katie by the door. What an explosion. Oh. Hulk Hogan has the wild battle. Oh, good. And drives it down. Hogan cleaning house. He is a one-man gang, Vince.
It's probably not what you meant, Gene, but I think he's more Akeem than the one-man gang just for the bright colors that he's wearing to the ring. But anyway, no pose routine either from Hogan. I mean, this is very early. Like I said, this is less than 3 months after he's won the championship. He's on both shows this weekend, and it's just a quick ass-kicking of a guy who was one half of the tag team champions only 4 or 5 months before this. So very impressive with Hogan following up that crazy entrance with just an absolute squash of one of the more dominant big guys in the WWF over the previous year.
Just a minute. The talk of professional wrestling, not only here in New York City, but throughout the wrestling world, the big one between Sergeant Slaughter and the Iron Sheik.
Soldier, pay attention very good. Remember what I did to Bob Backlund, the bring the Hogan, now the bring the American Marine. Remember, Ayatollah Blasi told me, Sheik, don't worry about it. You was the first human being. After 7 years, you take the belt from Bob Backlund, and they double cross me, they bring the Hogan. Now they bring the American Marine. همه ایرانی های دنیا میدونه منو. Soldier, remember, this time I'm gonna do some damage to you. To you know, your mother, your father, your kids. Nobody recognizes you after that. Listen, very good, Sergeant. What do you want to ask me?
Wait a minute. Sheik, I'm very curious. You go into a restaurant and you order a meal. Do you shout at your waiter the way you shout at...
Don't worry about it. This is my life. Look at all the medal. This is my game. This is my sport, soldier. You American double-crossed me. Now I'm going to take everything from you. Madison Square Garden. I know you jog. I know you run. That doesn't going to help. خدمت همه شنوندگان ایرانی از این سلام عرض میکنم مخصوصا احمد
رضایی Sergeant Slaughter, part of the action, Madison Square Garden, Monday night, don't sit there missing.
I listened to that and I love that entire thing, but like with most Iron Sheik promos, I couldn't quite figure out how this would translate into me explaining what it was or setting it up. So I just said, all right, well, why don't I just play the full 90 seconds or whatever it is, just let him go off and, oh, that is some good stuff. I mean, usually you think of the interviews where they're in like that studio, like I mentioned earlier, under the WWF logo. But, you know, sometimes these ringside interviews could be pretty good. My favorite of that genre that I've covered on this show is certainly that Don Morocco, Lou Albano one, which is kind of a time-traveling one because Gene Okerlund is there before he actually debuts. And he's talking about how Pat Patterson... Morocco is, how he's so boring, and now he just sits and picks his nose, and boring. That's also back in episode 46. Apparently, I really like that one, because I've been referencing it left and right, or so it seems. So, up next for our final bout, which almost feels like one of the old standby bouts, like what they would have in Mid-South and the NWA, like, oh yeah, the other match ended too early, so we gotta throw on this piece of shit. Tonga Kid taking on Tony Russo. And Tonga Kid, who I feel like turns up again and again, he eventually gets pushed as sort of the Jimmy Snuka surrogate when Snuka was too unreliable to be around or whatever. Not until late 84. Till then, he's pretty much like a gatekeeper guy. I've been using that phrase a lot recently. I think it's a little bit more kind than jobber to the stars. I mean, that's almost kind of a pejorative. Tonga Kid just reminds me how in wrestling, for some reason, because he's pushed as a Snuka surrogate, what, just because he's from a Pacific island, they're all the same? Like, why is it in wrestling? Like, Tonga equals Samoa equals Fiji? I swear, on the 83 World Class, there's a guy, Tonga John, who I believe eventually becomes the Barbarian, the real Barbarian, not Nord the Barbarian, the one from the Powers of Pain and the Faces of Fear. He's called Tonga John, but the ring announcer says from Samoa. And it's basically like, well, why the hell is he Tonga John if he's being billed from a different island? I know I should probably just do a world-class episode and explore that, but for God's sakes, they're not all the same place. I don't know. Is it racism? Probably not. It's just like, it's like Pacific Islander. It's like an ethnicity that you can check the box on the census. Tony Russo, there's not a whole lot with him. He once wrestled under the moniker El Diablo, which is like such like a generic thing. In fact, it was even a gag on The Simpsons when Talking Heads singer David Byrne was on there.
David Byrne?
Singer, artist, composer, director, Talking Head.
And I used to wrestle under the name El Diablo.
I thought that was Philip Glass.
Yeah, he wishes.
Early on, Tonga Kid actually walks the turnbuckles in order to execute a headlock takeover, which kind of feels like a lot to do to execute a very simple move. He does get a crossbody for two and then goes back to the side headlock takeover. And just a reminder that the Tonga Kid would go on to become Tama in the Islanders when both those guys just decided to rename themselves and get Tonga out of their name, because Haku was the rename of King Tonga, and the Tonga Kid becomes Tama. I don't know how they actually decided on that. Of course, their most famous moment as a tag team was kidnapping Matilda in late 1987. And wait a minute, we got some breaking news coming into the desk. Apparently, Matilda, not a real British bulldog. We'll have more information on that as the circumstances warrant, unless one of our aspiring wrestling journalists will go out there and expose this story for what it's worth and win their Pulitzer Prize. Oh, wait, nobody gives a shit. So anyway, Tonga Kid is only 18 years old here, so he wins the Mario Mancini Award. His birthday, October 11th, 1965, which, in case you're wondering, is the exact same day and year as Orlando Hernandez, El Duque, formerly of the Montreal Expos, and I guess he was on the New York Yankees at some point as well. Now, Dick Worley, at this point, I'm noticing his attire is very strange. Usually, of the WWF officials of this era, Danny Davis is kind of the wacky one who stands out when he's like wearing like khakis and like weird clothing. He's wearing Adidas track pants. What is going on? Did he, like, shit his pants in the back and, like, he had to change and that was all they had? As Russo works the left leg, head scissor to get out of it. And Tonga Kid, he must have been like, all right, the hour show is almost up. You got to go for the pin now. Flash, small package, three count. And to be honest, I'm okay with that because not a whole lot was going to be accomplished. But they do tease what is going to be the feature bout on next week's show.
Next week, what a matchup we promise you. B. Brian Blair coming into his own in the World Wrestling Federation. Really coming into his own to square off against Mr. Wonderful, Paul Orndorff, one-on-one competition. Gene Okerlund, who do you think will take the match?
I could not pick a winner in this one. Blair, tremendous amateur background. He's got some moves that simply amaze me.
What moves are those, Gene? What, the abdominal stretch into a roll-up that was a boring finisher even for 1984? Get the hell out of here. God, it's the guy, Paul Orndorff, who I've just completely run out of takes on, versus B. Brian Blair, the guy who I just don't want to talk about at all. So that's why I'm not doing the April 21st All-Star Wrestling. And hey, I can pick a winner in that one. It's going to be Paul Orndorff. I'm pretty sure of it. And that'll do it for WWF All-Star Wrestling for April 14th, 1984. Another podcast this week on the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing with the full complement of Mike Crockett, Brian Malonis, and Brian Fury. This week, they're talking about stuff that should come back to professional wrestling after last week talking about stuff that should just go away forever. My contribution to that would be, can we conduct interviews the way that they were done in the 80s and 90s? Not In the sense that they have to be done in a studio and it's one local promo after another. It should just be, could we allow the person conducting the interview to have a little bit of a personality? And for the love of God, do not be staring off into the freaking distance when the interview ends. That's not how it should work. But anyway, on the Our Vantage Point podcast, Joe Morana and Michael Quinn, they are they're actually starting a new Royal Rankings, and they are looking at best mangers, and I think the best manger of all time is the one that Jesus was born in Bethlehem. Managers. Okay, so they're talking about managers, you know, like Sensational Sherry, Paul Heyman, that sort of thing. Boy, I definitely have egg on my face after that one, because, yeah. So anyway, on the sportscasters, my good pal Steve Bennett, who is on the mend after a recent surgery, and I know how it feels. I now know how it feels to go under the knife. Premiere of season 10 for him. Great interview with Andrew Marchand of the New York Post. Steve turned me around on the concept of the Mike Francesa funhouse. The people who make the insulting videos about Mike Francesa, that was definitely a bad thing, because for a long time I thought, oh, they're keeping Mike relevant, and now he's basically off into the sunset on radio.com, never to be heard from again. But they were mocking him mercilessly, and they would do it in a way sometimes that would be out of context, as Steve pointed out. So that's an example of me listening to another podcast, taking into consideration what someone, Steve in this case, is saying, and saying, you know what, I think he's right. And I kind of did a 180 on that one. So do check that one out. Mercifully, there is no Vinny Vegas Corner this week because I am 1-9 in the NFL playoffs, which is absolutely freaking unbelievable. I don't think anybody has ever publicly done this bad on football picks. I just want to say, a couple of years ago, I went 9-2 in the playoffs. So I'm not a complete dolt here. I should know what I'm talking about. I mean, I don't even know what to say. There's absolutely no defense for it. I know that the Pro Bowl is this weekend, but I've always said that betting on the Pro Bowl is like the last sign of a gambler who needs help. But if you must, I would recommend taking the AFC. And usually I'd say take the underdog because nobody is trying in the game. But I say take the AFC because they generally win these games, and there's going to be a lot of pissed off Baltimore Ravens playing in that one. Didn't they have like 34 Pro Bowl selections, and they thought that they were going to the Super Bowl so that they wouldn't have to go? But oh well, that's just the way things work. The NHL All-Star Game is this weekend as well. I have no recommendations for that other than bet against the Atlantic Division, because Bruce Cassidy is coaching, and since he's the coach of the Bruins, we know he's incapable of coaching a team to a victory in a 3-on-3 situation. But without Vinny Vegas Corner this week, we can bring back one of the old great segments. Not entirely sure why I said we. It's just me and the cat down here, and the cat ain't making a peep. She's way the hell up on top of the bookcase, and I'd like to get her down from there, but she can just stay because she's not making a lot of noise. It's time for YouTube Comment Theater. This, as always, are actual YouTube comments left on the video in question by presumably actual YouTube users. This one's got about 25 or 30, so there's a decent selection to choose from. Says, or maybe it's MM, says, I love it. No frills, no talking, no BS, just wrestling, no acting. I miss the good old days when it was just wrestling and no sideshow. Well, I don't know about no acting. I mean, you know, this is a predetermined, scripted sport here. I mean, let's be honest. Gar Nunce says, the ace, my fave of all time, at 33 minutes, Frank Williams in the pit. And yes, that's undoubtedly the most celebrated thing from this particular episode. Jamie Barrow says, greatest Piper's Pit. Genius to have the jobber Frank Williams. Columbus, Ohio. I may be lousy wrestler, but I'm still in there. That is a great quote by Frank Williams that'll just live on forever. Jordy Mayer says, damn, Rocky Atlas and SD were muscular in a time when other wrestlers had bellies hanging out, etc. Well, SD Jones had a belly himself a little bit later in the 80s, but he was still in pretty good shape here in the middle of 84. Jersey Guy says, just like Jamie Below Me, crazy to think, I actually saw this when it originally aired in 84. Wow, thank you. He refers to the exact same broadcast, WWOR in Secaucus, Channel 9. And Sean McMillan says, is John Callahan related to Sammy Callahan of Impact? And the answer to that is almost certainly no. Like, Callahan, that's a pretty common Irish name. I mean, ugh. It's kind of like when somebody says, oh, you went to Boston University? Did you know blah, blah, blah? It's like, you do realize that there was like 30,000 people at that school when I was going there, let alone however many have gone in the years where I wasn't. Jamie Barrows says again, I was in fourth grade when I watched this. Thanks for taking me back. Love that you kept the commercials. And yes, anytime commercials are part of a wrestling program, I definitely enjoy it. Garnunce again, voice of Peter Thomas. He narrated Forensic Files. That was one of the commercials that I didn't really talk about. I think it might have been a repeat from one of the early ones. And John Galbraith says, LOL. That Bob Backlund promo / interview. I love it when the old adverts are kept in. I love them as much as the old wrestling footage. And yeah, like I just said, I definitely agree with that. That Bob promo was, it was a good promo up until the end where he admitted to touching kids, which could definitely be taken out of context. That'll do it for YouTube comment theater. Now, this is one of those weeks coming up where I'm leaving it wide open for what I'm going to do next. I probably won't do another WWF show again next week, although I reserve the right to change my mind. Dabbling around with World Class, Mid-South, WCW, early stage WCW, like the weird era of 89 where you don't know whether to call it WCW or the NWA. I usually just call it WCW/NWA. So, whenever it is, do stay tuned on social media, probably at GF Allentown Pod on Twitter, where I will announce that. And while you're waiting on that, subscribe on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or whatever your podcatcher is. There's probably a little subscribe button that is definitely appreciated. And please leave a review at whatever site, usually Apple Podcasts, that will allow you to leave such a thing. You know why you should do that? Because it's the right thing to do, and because it provides what is known as social proof that you are listening to and enjoying this particular podcast. I thank you in advance for that, and tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
The answers, I change the questions.